Avalon County Entertainment System. Channel Select. Avalon Broadcasting System. Channel 17. Program Start. 40,000 feet. Unplanned high energy event. 39,350 feet. New Avalon Aviation Cirrus X20DS jetpack suffers catastrophic failure of number 1 port side compressor disc. Structural failure of combustion chamber, turbine, follow. 38,500 feet. Uncontained fire spreads to number 2, starboard, turbine housing. Governors destroyed. Turbine runs away. 37,200 feet. Number 2 turbine disintegrates. Fire threatens to spread to fuel supply. Automatic safety system jettisons pack. Freefall begins. 36,900 feet. Remote telemetry indicates catastrophic pack failure. Likely cause, fuel explosion from uncontrolled structural fire. 36,500 feet. Sensors detect fire in dorsal outer envelope of XT-474 pressure environment suit. 34,720 feet. Fire begins compromising suit electrical system. Power assist and environmental control systems begin failing. 32,180 feet. Operator-initiated fire control protocol successfully extinguishes outer envelope fire. Electrical system continues failing. 31,200 feet. Operator initiates emergency distress broadcast. 30,200 feet. Complete electrical failure. Transmission terminated. Log file ends. Flying Yak Studios and Bacon Comics Group, in association with the International Police Organization and Avalon Broadcasting System, present Lensman, the Brave and the Bold, Our Witches at War, another serial experiment. Episode 1, The Man Who Fell to Earth, Again. Monday, April 1st, 1946, near Ribeauvillé, Gallia. As a glorious dawn broke over the green hills of Alsace, Sonia V. Jutelainen Litviak was reaching the end of another long day at the office. She was pottering along toward home, props drooping, flying more or less on autopilot, as she often did at this stage of her working day. She yawned, a hand in front of her mouth, and then smiled as she anticipated her favorite part of the day. Soon she'd be back home, able to take off her Stryker unit, get out of her uniform, and fall into bed, to savor that delicious hour and a half or so before Ayla had to get up and start her day. Sonia giggled lightly, recalling a time when the Swomish witch had been convinced that her Orussian counterpart was wandering into the wrong room by accident. As if that would happen every day? She had noticed early on that Ayla wasn't about to tip her off to her mistake, anyway. The reddish stone bulk of Chateau St. Ulrich, where the 501st was headquartered these days, came into view. Sonia didn't like it as well as she had their place in Britannia, but it was all right as these things went. A bit drafty, since it had been abandoned for a long time even before Gallia had spent years under the occupation of the Nuroi, and even the miracle-working engineers of the Allied forces could only do so much. It was comfortable enough, though, and really, Sonia would have been happy anywhere so long as she had her lover and their friends around them. She was just preparing to make her final approach to the castle when her dimly passive magic antenna suddenly brightened to full life again, an electric something crackling across her synapses and bringing her instantly out of her pleasant drowse. Nuroi? No. Nothing like their unique electromagnetic signature. A signal, a radio transmission, on a frequency not normally used by any of the forces in the area, weak but pulsing with an intangible urgency. Sonia tilted her head and concentrated, her antenna brightening further as she worked to tune in the signal.
Mayday, mayday, anyone on this frequency? Red 14. Okay.
I am at flight level 30 and have lost all power. Angel 30 and nothing's working. Anybody out there, I could really use a hand.
Gone. Not just the voice, but the signal itself, its carrier wave suddenly vanishing from her awareness. The contact had been brief, but long enough for her to get a sense of its direction, and despite the liberal soaking of static, she had recognized the speaker's voice. She had no idea how he had come to be here, but if he needed help... Sonya aborted her landing approach, turned and throttled up, bringing her Yak-9 Striker to full power again. She felt a dull ache somewhere deep within her as she tapped reserves of strength she rarely called upon, making full speed at the end of a long day's patrol. But from the sound of things, there was no time to be lost. She'd just have to make it work somehow. At dawn, there would be no one else to do it. Griffin had been reasonably sure that he was about to, if not die, at least end up in a whole lot of pain for quite a long time. Falling 7.5 miles would tend to do that to a person. Instead, at some point before the big crunch would have happened, having lost all his instruments at 30,000 feet, he had no precise idea where. His ad hoc mental count had him at about 5,000, but that was little better than a guess. He'd felt a heavy but not catastrophic side impact, followed by what he could only summarize mentally as an embrace. And then there were several seconds of quiescence. And then a hard, but far from fatal, impact with the ground. And the next thing he knew, he was tumbling end over end in a welter of flying sod before fetching up face down against some solid obstacle or another. At this point, he'd have liked to open his visor and find out what was going on, but he couldn't. The failure of his XT-474 was so complete that its power-assisted limbs were not just dead, but frozen. And barring a supreme effort, he wasn't going to be doing any moving around to speak of without help. With his head stuck in one position, he couldn't even look around, just wait and hope that whatever was going on outside eventually wandered in front of his visor. Right now, all that view was showing him was that he'd come to rest someplace grassy. At least with the suit vents having opened under atmospheric pressure at 10,000 feet, he wasn't going to run out of air and smother while he waited for it. A few seconds later, he found himself dragged partway upright and propped in a semi-sitting position against whatever he'd crashed into. A momentary swinging glimpse suggested it was a tree. Hands fumbled at his helmet visor, then unlatched it and swung it up, and he found himself looking at a familiar but entirely unexpected face. Pale skin, silver hair, big worried eyes of a remarkable deep green. A bit older than when he'd last seen her, maybe 15? It would always be hard to tell with bone structure like hers. She didn't seem as surprised to see him as he was to see her, but then she'd always held her feelings pretty close to the vest. "It is you," she said softly. Griffin smiled. "Hello, Sonya. Boy, am I glad to see you." Upon closer inspection, Sonya was looking a bit rumpled, her uniform torn and grass-stained. Her black tights were holed in several places, and her tie was askew. A short distance away, he could see the two parts of her Striker unit lying discarded in the grass, undamaged but plainly inoperative. "Did you crash?" Griffin wondered. "A little," Sonya replied with a flicker of wry humor. "It's morning," she explained, figuring that he would remember enough of her daily routine from the old days to understand the significance of that. "I used up the last of my magic getting you down in one piece. Can you move?" "Nope," Griffin replied. "This suit's... was... powered. It's totally dead. I hope you've got a radio." She nodded. "No one will be awake right now," she said, "but in an hour or so I can..." The sound of an automobile engine reached them, and then the cheery beeping of a horn. Griffin instinctively tried to turn his head and look, but failed. Instead, he saw Sonya look to her left and smile, albeit with mild surprise. "Ayla," she said, sounding relieved. "What are you doing here?" "Under the circumstances, I think that's my line," said a familiar voice in reply. And a moment later, the equally familiar blue-and-white-clad figure of Ayla Ilmatar Utilainen Litviak stepped into Griffin's field of view, crouching like a baseball catcher next to Sonya. "What did you do?" she asked, fussing at the torn bits of Sonya's uniform and brushing away flecks of grass and dirt. "And what the heck is this thing?" she started to add, turning to regard the object crumpled at the base of the tree. "Hey, Ayla," said Griffin. Ayla blinked once, slowly, then nodded. "Oh," she said. "Of course. What else?" "Pardon?" "When I woke up and Sonya wasn't there, I checked the cards to see if I could tell where she was," Ayla explained. Reaching into one of the pouches on her belt, she produced a couple of tarot cards and displayed them. "The Magician and the Wheel of Fortune." With a wry little grin, she added, "In hindsight, what else could it mean?" Sonya and Griffin glanced at each other, then shrugged, or, well, she did, anyway. Neither had any real idea what the Swomish witch was talking about at this point, but it didn't really matter. What was important was that she was here, and she brought a vehicle. Missing the byplay, Ayla straightened up, brushing dust from the knees of her white tights, and said, "All right, let's get you back to base." Tilting her head inquisitively, she added, "What the heck are you wearing here?" "It used to be a pressure suit," Griffin explained while Ayla got hold of one of his arms and Sonya the other. He didn't bother telling them they weren't going to be able to shift him. Neither one was a big woman. Sonya was tiny and fine-boned, and Ayla, though more rugged by comparison, was hardly what a person would call husky. But he knew that, like all the witches of this world, they were much stronger than they looked. Even so, his suit was so heavy and its locked joints so rigid that it took a good bit of grunting and cursing, mainly on Ayla's part, before they were able to woman-handle him into the back seat of the Kubelwagen Ayla had driven out in search of her partner. Once they had him situated, they went back for Sonya's striker unit. This they lashed to the rear deck of the vehicle, after which Ayla got behind the wheel. Sonya climbed in back next to Griffin, and they set off. It was pleasant countryside, and Griffin spent a bit of the ride back trying to place where they were. Could have been anywhere with a reasonably temperate climate, he supposed, but given what he knew about the 501st Joint Fighter Wing's habits, he guessed they were someplace in northwestern Europe. Gallia, or the Low Countries, maybe. He was finding it hard to concentrate for some reason. There was something nagging at the back of his mind that he couldn't seem to focus on. After spending a while unsuccessfully trying to pin it down, he decided to stick to things he could get a handle on and asked, "So this is going to seem like a weird question, but when am I?" 1946, Ayla called back over her shoulder. "April Fool's Day." "Well, that figures," he mused. "Obvious next question is where?" "Gallia," Sonya said. "A district called Alsace, in the northeast of the country." "Oh, I know Alsace," said Griffin, sounding a little abstracted. "My grandmother's people come from there, which makes me, what, a quarter Alsatian." He snickered. "The rest is probably Labrador Retriever." Ayla looked back at him, a puzzled look on her face. "Are you drunk or something?" "No, but I do feel a little weird," he admitted. "I think it's just shock." With a crooked grin, he added, "An unplanned dimensional cross-rip will do that to a person." "Right. Abruptly, she pulled the Kubelwagen over to the side of the road and tugged the handbrake on, then turned around in the driver's seat. "I just thought, How are we going to get him into the base? We've got those sentries now. If we try to explain what's really going on, they'll either think we're crazy, or worse, believe us. That's true, Sonya mused. They sat and thought for a moment. Then, brightening, Sonya rummaged in the pocket on the back of the driver's seat and came out with an old operations manual. Ripping off the back cover, she turned it over, got out the marker pen she used to make patrol notes, and wrote M.A. in big square letters on the blank inner side. Then, after a moment's pause to think, she nodded and finished the sign, Q-U-E-T-T-E. That done, she put the pen and the now backless manual away, turned to Griffin, and, without explanation, wedged the sign into his helmet over his face. "Hey, what?" he said, but before he could finish the question, Sonya shut his visor again, cutting off the sound. Ayla regarded the pair in the back seat for a second, then grinned, faced front, and set the car in motion again. "You are a devious little Orussian witch," she declared, "and I love you." "Thank you," said Sonya, a touch of color coming into her cheeks. When they arrived at the fence, one of the two sentries on duty flagged them to a halt by the barber pole gate and leaned down to consider the vehicle's contents. "What the heck is that thing?" wondered the man, a burly sergeant in the battle dress of the Liberian Army. "High-altitude survival suit," Ayla replied. "We're testing it for the Orussian Air Force." With a rueful grin, she added, "Between you and me, I don't think it's going to work out." "What's the sign mean?" the sergeant asked. "Gaelic for dummy," Sonya said softly. "So if it gets away from us in a test and civilians find it in a field somewhere, they won't freak out and try to give it first aid or anything," Ayla explained. And then, having a flash of inspiration, added with a wink, "We call him Ivan Ivanovich." The sergeant laughed, then turned, opened the gate, and saluted. "Well, you better put Ivanovich to bed. He looks like he's already had a tough day," he said. "Ha ha, right," Ayla replied. Then she put the Kubelwagen in gear and drove away. As the sergeant stood and watched them drive off into the base grounds, the corporal manning the other side of the road came across to stand next to him. For a moment, watching the witches drive away, neither spoke. "Hey, Sarge? What do witches need with a survival suit?" the corporal wondered. "Hell if I know, Plumson," the sergeant replied. They dragged Ivan Ivanovich into the hangar, over to the corner that the 501st used as an impromptu meeting room, and dumped him in the corner, where he assumed a sort of slumped sitting position, wedged into the angle where the walls met. "Okay," said Ayla. "You put your striker away. I'm going to go round up the others so we can tell them what's going on." 5 minutes later, with Sonya's striker unit back in its launch stage to be tended by the maintenance crew later in the day, Ayla was back with as many members of the squadron as she'd been able to round up at breakfast. The turnout was a little disappointing. She hadn't been able to find Lynn, Yoshka, Hartman, Mina, or Major Sakamoto on such short notice. And Heide Marie Schnaufer, the outfit's other night witch, was in bed. But the others were accounted for, and she was at least able to put out the word for the rest. Hartman was probably still asleep, and the Major was almost certainly out running the perimeter or some damn thing at this hour. As the others, curious at their sudden summons and the fact that Sonya was still awake, took seats around the improvised conference table, Ayla experienced another of her little flashes of inspiration. Shizuka Hattori, the recruit from Fuseau who had come back with Miyafuji the previous fall and still the FNG, was just about to take a seat when Ayla told her in a peremptory sort of voice, "Not there, new kid." She pointed at the slumped, rather charred-looking suit in the corner and said, "You sit there." Shizuka halted her behind an inch or so above the chair she'd been about to take, straightened up again, and looked where Ayla was pointing, then back at her swoomish wingmate with a not-sure-if-serious sort of expression. What? When Pilot Officer Ivanovich is among us, said Ayla importantly, the junior pilot in the squadron has to sit in his lap. It's traditional. You just made that up, Shizuka replied, folding her arms. You'll never prove it, Sergeant Hattori, Ayla replied with a slightly wicked grin. Shizuka gave a long, suffering sigh, wondering for what felt like about the 500,000th time what had ever possessed her to think that being a member of the legendary 501st would be cool, and went unwillingly to stand by the suit. It sat there, knees bent, back against the wall, arms outstretched like the Frankenstein monsters. It didn't look very comfortable, and it smelled like burnt electrical wiring. She didn't really want to touch it, let alone use it as a chair, but an order was an order. With a look of distaste, she turned back to Ayla and said, "What's the point of this tradition?" "It's like... do you have Yolupuki in Fuso?" Ayla asked. "Do we have what?" Shizuka wondered as she lowered herself gingerly into the charred suit's awkward, stiff-armed embrace. "Is that that horrible, salty licorice? No, we don't have that." Ayla shook her head. "No, that's salmiakki, and it's not horrible." "Yeah, 10 out of 10 normal people beg to differ with you there," said Shirley Yeager dryly, drawing a stifled snicker out of Perrine Klosterman and a not-so-stifled one from Francesca Lucchini. Ayla turned an entreating look to her wife. "Sonia, back me up here." Sonia glanced reluctantly away and said softly, "I'm sorry, Lapochka. It's revolting." Seeing Ayla's stricken look of betrayal, Perrine felt a little sorry for her and offered, "General Vilka likes it." "Mina eats sardines straight out of the can," Shirley pointed out, while Lucchini made a disgusted face. "Well, true," Perrine conceded. Ayla palmed her face. "Anyway, no," she went on. "Not that. Yolupuki is Swamish Father Christmas."
"I think in Fuso they call him by his Liberian name, Santa Claus," Sonia put in, as if trying to make up slightly for her complete abdication of helpfulness a moment before. Shizuka furrowed her brow. "What does Santa-san have to do with making me sit on a burned-out diving suit?"
"Looks more like a space suit to me," Shirley put in. "Like in Buck Rogers."
"Right, Yeager. I'm sure it's really a visitor from the 25th century," said Gertrude Barkhorn, rolling her eyes. Then, with a thoughtful frown, she added, "Although that does raise the question of what it actually is," Shizuka agreed. She opened the suit's helmet visor and plucked out the hand-lettered Maquette card, expecting to see the blank face of a mannequin behind it.
Hi, said Griffin.
"Yeah!"
Shizuka cried, all but levitating out of his lap.
"Yes!"
Ayla hissed, making a little pumped fist gesture of triumph.
"Swamis 1, Fuso nothing."
"That was mean, Lapochka,"
Sonia reproved her mildly.
"Was I just used as the central prop in a Swamish opera?" Griffin wondered as the flustered Fusonese girl, whom he didn't recognize, hurriedly left the area.
"Yes, yes you were," said Barkhorn. Fists on hips, she regarded him thoughtfully for a second, then smiled and said, "I have to admit I wasn't expecting to see you again."
"Yay!"
cried Lucchini, propelling herself into his lap now that Shizuka was out of the way.
"You came back!"
Then she sat back and gave him a reproachful frown. "You're not hugging,"
she said in an annoyed sing-song.
I can't, Griffin replied, trying and failing to move. Suit's frozen. I can't move a muscle.
Shirley grinned and cracked her knuckles.
Well, all right, then, she said. Let's get this party started. It's not every day I get to strip a spaceman.
Mina Dietlinde Vilke had just entered the hangar, mulling over the curious message she'd received. Why would Ayla, of all people, call an emergency squadron meeting at 8:30 in the morning? When she noticed the ruckus happening over in the meeting room area. At first, she took it for some kind of wrestling match. Shirley and Truda seemed to be involved, so that was hardly out of the question. But as she drew nearer, she heard the unmistakable sound of a man's voice from someplace in the melee, remarking dryly,
"Well, I designed it to come apart, so..."
A moment later, Mina's confusion deepened as she heard Lucchini wail,
"I can't get his pants off! Shirley!"
"Well, hold on, let me help you," Shirley replied, repositioning herself. "If I can just get some leverage on this dang thing, maybe I can..."
"Shirley?" Mina inquired as she reached the edge of the meeting room. "What's going on here?"
What was going on appeared to be that Shirley was crouching on the floor astride the hips of the sprawled figure of a man in what looked like a bulky, badly damaged diving suit, one of her feet braced against the leg of the conference table, while Truda Barkhorn wrangled his arms and shoulders from behind in a sort of Nelson hold, Perrine tugged on one of his gloves, Sonya and Ayla pulled on his boots, and Lucchini pried at the metal fittings of his suit's articulated waist. For a moment, nobody spoke, all faces, including that of the man in the suit, gazing in silent disconcertion at the wing commanders. Then Shirley said matter-of-factly,
"Let's face it, this is not the worst thing you've caught us doing."
"Who in the world?" Mina began, but then she belatedly recognized the slightly pale, rather sweaty face of the man in the battered suit and let out a faint, startled gasp.
"Well, hello, Colonel, excuse me, Brigadier, Vilke," said Griffin, noticing the changed rank badge on her uniform's collar.
"How lovely to see you again. Excuse me if I don't get up."
Meanwhile, Lynette Bishop, Yoshika Miyafuji, and a still drowsy Erica Hartman entered the hangar by a different door a minute or so behind Mina, having come from the residence wing, and so missed all that. But unlike the commander, they did encounter Shizuka Hattori, who was hovering by that door watching whatever was happening over in the far corner with a look of startled dismay.
"Are you okay, Shizuka-chan?"
Yoshika asked, concern on her face.
"You look pale."
"There's a man," Shizuka blurted, still so flustered she was barely able to get the words out in the right order.
"Well, yeah, I think you'll find there are a lot of men," Erica replied, arching an eyebrow.
"About half the people on the planet."
"No, I mean in here,"
Shizuka insisted. Yoshika looked puzzled.
"Our mechanics are mostly men," she said. "Haven't you noticed?"
Her face going red, Shizuka seized Yoshika by the front of her medical smock and shook her, demanding,
"Are you really this dense, Miyafuji, or are you just messing with me now?"
"I like that she's starting to show some spirit," Eric amused to Lynn.
"Hmm,"
Lynn agreed with a little nod. Then, looking past the two Fuseau witches' little tableau, the blonde Karlslander blinked.
"Huh, there is a man," she said, and then, looking more closely, "Hey, I know that man!"
"You do?" asked all three of the younger witches, but Erica wasn't paying them any attention. Now she was darting over to help with the suit dismantling.
"This is what we get for being late for staff meetings, Yoshika,"
Lynn mused.
"This is not working," Shirley grunted, tugging uselessly at one of Griffin's sleeves.
"Maybe if we used an impact wrench." "Everybody stand clear," said Truda, leaning Griffin against the wall so she could come around to the front of the group. Shoving up her sleeves, she went on, "I'll handle this myself." "No," cried Lucchini, Mina, Ayla, Sonya, and Griffin simultaneously. "Yeah, bad idea," Shirley agreed. Truda frowned. "Well, fine, then there's only one thing left to do," she said. "Go get the saw. We'll have to cut his arms and legs off." Here she angled a thumb back over her shoulder. "And Miyafuji can put them back on afterward."
"That's not..."
Yoshika began. Before she could finish, Lucchini wailed, "No!" and threw herself protectively onto Griffin again, huddling against his chest and shaking her head so furiously the motion threw tears aside in sparkly arcs.
"Jeez, Barkhorn, what are you trying to do?"
Shirley demanded, leaning down to pry her distraught wingman off and gather her up in a hug.
"Shh, shh, she didn't mean it. No one's going to cut up Griff."
"I was only kidding," said Truda lamely, her expression one of startled horror.
"For Pete's sake, Truda," said Erica with a sad shake of her head. "You can't say something like that with a straight face and expect anyone to realize you're not serious."
"I was just trying to lighten up a little," Truda protested, her voice quavering, a helpless look on her face, as she watched Shirley try to comfort Lucchini and all the rest gave her reproachful looks. Hartman regarded her for a second, then sighed.
"Aw, you're so cute," she said, softening. "Come here."
"Ladies," said Mina, "the situation is not yet resolved."
"Yeah, yeah, be there in a second," Erica replied. "We're having a moment over here."
Eventually, with the use of most of the readily available hand tools, except the saw, they did get him pried out of the suit, although not without mostly destroying it in the process. Fortunately for his own sensibilities, if not necessarily anyone else's present, he was wearing a sort of black jumpsuit underneath it, which appeared none the worse for its wearer's adventure. Sitting at the conference table, he worked his way out of the last piece of the outer suit, the clamshell of chest and back plates, and set its halves down on the table.
"This looks like it didn't go according to plan," Shirley quipped, observing the jagged remains of the jetpack mounting points on the back plate.
"Not as such," Griffin agreed.
"Are you okay?" Shirley inquired.
"If this is from what I think it's from, that must have been a hell of a ride." Griffin nodded.
"Sure," he said. "I'm fine. Never better."
He looked up as the one person missing from his internal count of squadron members arrived. Mio Sakamoto, a towel around her neck where she'd just finished her morning workout, trotting in with a concerned look on her face from the door Mina had arrived by earlier.
"What's going on?" she asked. "I just got the..."
She skidded to a halt, both physical and verbal, as the little group of her colleagues by the table parted at her approach, and she saw who was sitting at the end.
"Hello, Mio," said Griffin. "Been a while. You're looking well."
Observing the towel and her general air of flushed sweatiness, he added with a little smile, "Still keeping fit, I see." Mio stared at him for a moment, her one visible eye blinking a couple of times. Then, relaxing, she smiled back and asked wryly, "Are you hitting on me?"
"Major Sakamoto," Griffin replied, drawing himself up with an air of wounded dignity. "I did not come all this way to flirt with you."
"Fair enough," Mio replied.
"Then what are you doing?"
"Don't get me wrong," Griffin interrupted her, rising to his feet. "I'll happily do so. But it's not why I came." And then, his voice cutting off in mid-sentence, he pitched forward, bounced off the corner of the table, and sprawled face down on the floor, his arm wiping the scattered pieces of armor off the table as he went down.
"What the?" Shirley blurted, kneeling beside him with her hand on his back. Griff? You okay?
Ah!
Lucchini screamed suddenly. The others turned to see her standing a few feet away, pointing in horror at the piece of the suit that had ended up at her feet in the confusion. It was the piece that had been the back of the torso, and it had come to rest upside down, so that the inner surface was facing up. The padding within it was sodden and crimson, the reason for which was obvious. A jagged chunk of metal, what had been part of the outer plating, had been blown inward by whatever had done the external damage Shirley had noticed earlier, and now jutted up wickedly from the middle of the plate, a bit to the right of center. Shirley lifted her hand from his back and found it sticky with blood, which had been invisible against the black material of his jumpsuit, but was now spreading around him in a slowly growing scarlet pool.
"Oh, not good," said Erica.
"Miyafuji!" Mio snapped, swinging instantly into crisis mode.
"I'm on it," Yoshiko replied firmly. "Give me room, everybody."
Airy Productions Unlimited, Flying Yak Studios and Bacon Comics Group, in association with the International Police Organization and Avalon Broadcasting System, presented Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Lensman, the Brave and the Bold, Our Witches at War, Episode 1, The Man Who Fell to Earth, Again. Written and directed by Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, that's me, with Matt Wagner and the EPU Usual Suspects. Based on characters from Strike Witches, created by Humikane Shimada. Bacon Comics Chief, Derek Bacon. Our Witches at War will return.